from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, immigration, Eric Holder, and a shaky economy all in the spotlight. Plus, an early summer heat wave sweeps in. In a big speech on immigration in Lake Buena Vista, Florida, Mitt Romney went after the president.
He did nothing to advance a permanent fix for our broken immigration system. Nothing.
Republicans tore into Attorney General Eric Holder and the White House over Fast and Furious. Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York called it empty fury.
It shouldn't be a political witch hunt against the Attorney General of our country and our president in an election year.
And record-breaking heat from Midwest to Northeast. In New York's Central Park, Meredith Hartz was melting down.
Just feels like I am melting constantly. Like all my makeup is dripping off my face. It's disgusting.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Harwood of CNBC and the New York Times, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Is that your bank downgraded your fury in Congress? Who's singing your tune on immigration? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear some of Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi's stirring address this week to the British Parliament. Joining us now from Washington is John Harwood, chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, writer for the New York Times. John, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, where her big cover story right now is head of state. It's looking at Hillary Clinton and diplomacy in the Twitter era. Susan Glasser, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, the unparalleled Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, John, and Susan.
Can we go straight to the economy first? We've got all these big downgraded banks, all this trouble in Europe, markets still rocking. It's underlying everything. Susan Glasser, we had heads of state in Mexico, Baja California this week, G20 looking at fixing this. Here we are, end of the week, downgraded banks, markets unhappy, and it doesn't look like we've found the floor.
I think that's right. If you're looking for a sure bet, this is that meetings between heads of state at this point are not going to produce fixes that last for the long term in the global economy. We have four more European heads of state getting together in Italy today, and I think we can predict a similarly inconclusive result.
I mean, this just gets more and more obsessing for the world. Everybody watching Europe, but there's the U.S. economy as well. Here was the president in Los Cabos, Mexico on Tuesday.
G20 leaders all supported Europe working in partnership with the next Greek government to ensure that they remain on a path to reform and sustainability within the Eurozone. Another positive step forward was the Eurozone's commitment to work on a more integrated financial architecture, including banking supervision, resolution, and recapitalization, as well as deposit insurance.
John Harwood, there's the president ticking off the list of we wish this and we wish that in Mexico. Meanwhile, just all over economies, and you can look at China, you can look at India, you can look at Brazil, let alone the U.S. and Europe. I mean, this is the issue behind everything else now, John.
It is, and the whole industrialized world is kicking the can down the road. It's one of those prisoner's dilemma situations where it's in everybody's interest. Within the United States, both parties in Europe, all members of the Eurozone, to work in concert. But it's difficult for any individual actor at any particular point to see their self-interest in stepping up and doing what's necessary for cooperation. And so European countries and the IMF now putting pressure on Angela Merkel to try to get Germany to commit to a greater degree than they have so far to rescuing the Eurozone. But it's very, very difficult. And the United States is not in any great position to give lectures, given our difficulties resolving our own long-term debt.
Ben Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, talking this week about what they would do, a little more of Operation Twist. We'll see if that has any impact. It's not a big step. Here he was speaking on Wednesday about the country's economic recovery still facing serious challenges.
Incoming information suggests that the economy continues to expand at a moderate pace in the face of headwinds generated by the situation in Europe, a still depressed housing market, tight credit for some borrowers, and fiscal restraint at the federal, state, and local levels.
And no big big dramatic move by the Fed. I mean, Jack, for ordinary people trying to understand what's going on here and look ahead, I mean, we constantly hear that job creators don't know what to do. Nobody knows what to do here.
no one knows what to do. And just hold the lens on the Fed for a minute. Mr. Bernanke said we still do have the scope to do more. We are prepared to do more. John Cassidy in the New Yorker says, well, one thing they could do is a QE3, an expansion of the money supply, and they could perhaps do that in their July 31st, August 1st meeting. But others say, wait a minute, the Fed would be very unlikely to get involved so close to the election and very unlikely to make so controversial a decision. So who knows how that's going to go?
I mean, what do we see here, Susan? When you look at Europe, are they moving toward a solution, or do we still have to wait and watch as the whole EU comes apart and the rest of the world tries to figure out how to work around that?
Well, I think the latter part of your statement is probably most on point here. Remember that we're looking at something like two-thirds of the governments in Europe have turned over the course of this now protracted economic crisis. What's happened is that market contagion has leaped over into the political system of Europe in a way that means that we're not looking at any permanent solutions anytime soon. And in fact, quite the reverse. Now, the political instability that was caused by the markets is probably going to lead to a new round of market instability. And I think the real question, as we've already talked about, is how much does that leap over across the Atlantic and affect potentially President Obama's reelection bid?
15 big banks with their ratings cut, some very low here. Citigroup, Bank of America, just down in near junk grade status now. You got people in the industry saying, well, that's late. The banks have actually shored up their finances. They're in better shape than that would indicate. But plenty of just things in motion on the economy side and not in a happy way. I want to turn to immigration. President Obama made it a big deal just a week ago when he said he would create a way by executive order for young immigrants with clean records to stay in this country, have work permits. Mitt Romney in Florida yesterday speaking to a big Hispanic group there, we heard him at the top saying Obama's failed on immigration to offer any big solution. He was then addressing what he would do on the president's executive order, this sort of almost virtual Dream Act, which Republicans pushed against under Obama. Obama pushed for. Here's what he would do.
Some people have asked if I will let stand the president's executive order. The answer is that I will put in place my own long-term solution that will replace and supersede the president's temporary measure.
Mitt Romney there in Florida yesterday, of course. John Harwood, what's going on with immigration here in the back and forth between the two contenders for the White House?
Well, first of all, if you parse Mitt Romney's statement, it sounds as if he was saying yesterday that he would leave the president's order in place until his long-term solution is passed. That's kind of interesting because it's something that he refused to commit to when he did Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer a few days ago. But
you've got to read pretty hard into it to see that. I mean, maybe that's
yes,
what he's
saying. Yes, although he said his solution would replace the president's short-term measure. He didn't say he would eliminate the president's short-term measure and then pursue long-term immigration. But step back from that. More broadly, we've got an Hispanic electorate that has grown to 9% of people voting in 2008. It's the fastest growing part of the electorate. It will be bigger than that in 2012. Mm-hmm. Republicans are way on the short side of that, and they can't stay on the short side of that to the same extent and continue to prosper in national politics. The president has taken a measure reflecting his inability to get broader immigration reform through Congress and, in effect, stolen an idea that Republicans, Marco Rubio, potential running mate for Mitt Romney, has been talking about and put Mitt Romney in a box because Mitt Romney has spent much of the primary season appealing to white conservatives who are very concerned about immigration and the changes it makes in the American economy and the American culture. That's why it was so difficult to read his intentions in that statement, because he's trying to walk a fine line.
Very kind of ambiguous exactly what he's saying. But, Jack, there were some things he was happy to say loud and clear, that he would support giving legal status to illegal immigrants who serve in the military, that he would, quoting him here, staple a green card to diplomas of immigrants who received advanced college degrees. I mean, he put out some positive things there, but then a lot of ambiguity around the whole picture.
Yes, and we didn't hear anything about self-deportation. We didn't hear anything about the Arizona immigration law, which will be salient next week when the Supreme Court delivers its verdict on that. And, you know, when you look at the polls, you see his dilemma. Whereas 64% of Americans favored the president's executive order, essentially allowing undocumented young people to extend their stay in the country and get work permits, and 86% of Democrats, 66% of independents, 56% of Republicans were opposed. So Mr. Romney is really tethered strongly to their opposition. On the other hand, while the president has been consolidating his 34-point national lead over Obama among Hispanics, Romney has been consolidating white vote, according to the Gallup poll. There's been a decrease just in the last month of 6 points in Obama's support among white voters, that going to Romney.
That's pretty interesting. Susan Glasser, is Romney saying, trying to appeal on the credibility front? Because Obama made promises during his campaign. He pushed for some of those. He did not get a big immigration package through here. Romney's saying, I'll keep my promises to you. But then the promises, Susan, kind of vague.
I think that's a good point. I think in the end, what we're looking at is that Obama obviously has a much stronger position among this key group of voters. And it's hard to see that Romney is really going to make inroads, even though he's got some leg to stand on when it comes to whether Obama's delivered on his promises.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Holder and contempt, big bank downgrade, Sandusky, the Trayvon case, and courting the Latino vote in presidential politics this hour. John Harwood is with us from CNBC and the New York Times. Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, is here, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's hear from our listeners. Alejandro is calling. Alejandro, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a thought on the immigration issue that you've been discussing. I mean, on one hand, it seems to me extremely clear that the political ploy on the part of the Obama administration. On the other hand, it's immensely disingenuous to me, anyways, for Mitt Romney to suggest that the reason why comprehensive reform hasn't passed or hasn't been attempted is because of Obama's inaction, when it seems very clear that it's in large part GOP obstructionism. So I just wanted to find out from your panel, what do they think is kind of what kind of traction do they think Romney's going to get from this claim?
Let's pick it up. We've got lots of people speaking to that line. John Harwood, I mean, what's fair here? In Mitt Romney's critique yesterday, you've got lots of people online saying, come on, this is a big lie that Obama didn't try to deliver on what he promised in his campaign. On the other hand, it's first and foremost the DREAM Act people point to, and yes, that was obstructed, but what about Obama's promise to put major immigration reform more broadly on the table?
Well, it is true that President Obama has not pushed aggressively for comprehensive immigration reform, but why hasn't he done that? The reason is it can't be passed. Why can't it be passed? Because of the resistance of Republican conservatives. That's Alejandro's point. Remember that during the Bush administration, you had a Republican president, George W. Bush, Republican leaders in the Senate, as well as a bipartisan group, John McCain, mm-hmm. Ted Kennedy, all mm-hmm. pushing a comprehensive reform that was taken down by the Republican right. That cannot be resurrected right now, in part because of the sentiments that Mitt Romney was appealing to mm-hmm. in Republican primaries. So, it is a fact that Obama hasn't pushed for comprehensive reform, but he really had no choice because it's impossible to achieve in this context.
You look at the track record and wonder how Romney might achieve something, but yet it's a political imperative, we're told, Jack, for the GOP to do something here. I mean, do you think that's filtering through or might filter through in a Romney administration to Capitol Hill, or would he be lashed back to the kind of really tough posture he had in the primaries?
Well, you know, if he could talk sense to his party and say, look at the demographic future here. This is where the vote is going. It's already gone in California, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, on and on. We have to get right with this growing group. But could he say that? I just don't know. I see that Ryan Lizza this week in The New Yorker, in an interesting piece about what Mr. Obama would do in his second term, thinks that the best prospect for him would be immigration reform, because if the Republicans lost the election and lost all those states where the Hispanic vote was so important, they might finally recognize reality and say, well, we have to make some accommodation here, and it would be in their political interest to make a deal.
Susan Glasser, this is so interesting. We see, you know, these big countries kind of dancing over this. Of course, so many immigrants from Mexico, and with that growing weight in the electorate, no matter what people think, it's coming into the political equation. I mean, we're talking here as these candidates appeal to the Hispanic vote, is it seemed like some kind of reorganization of the relationship of demographic groups here.
Well, that's right. I think that's a very important point, is that the electoral math is such that this could actually make a difference in some key states this year, Colorado being one of them, but not the only one for President Obama, as he's looking
at Florida, Nevada, Virginia, right on.
That's right. So he's looking at the new map. On the other hand, I'm actually struck by how, in many ways, ironically outdated this debate over immigration in the United States is. 20 years from now, when you look at the demographics, we are going to be begging for skilled Mexican workers and otherwise to come to the United States. And, you know,
because of the aging population in the U.S., or why exactly?
Well, that's exactly right, and the needs to keep growing our economy, and also because Mexico's economy is growing at a big clip. In fact, there's interesting data just out showing that Mexico might be overtaking Brazil as the new powerhouse economically in terms of growth in Latin America. And I think as Mexico develops more, you will see that more Mexicans will, of course, want to stay in Mexico, and they have their own fast-growing society to think about. So
we're seeing that already with the numbers coming over the border way, way, way down in recent years.
Well, that's right. That now, of course, that's also a reflection of the U.S. economic troubles over the past several years. But what the experts are predicting is that those numbers are not going to bounce back the way that they have after previous U.S. recessions. And I think that's something to watch.
Eve in Coralville, Iowa. Eve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am an Army veteran, and during my service, I was with a significant number of documented immigrants who had enlisted in the military.
Okay.
But as far as I know, if you are undocumented or you have overstayed your visa, you are not eligible to enlist in the military, which leads me to wonder, these two groups that were specified, those who had served in the military or those who had
advanced degrees,
accomplished education.
Yeah.
Leads me to wonder, you know, if you stood there and said, yes, I have served, and it turns out your enlistment was not proper, you're automatically, you know, breaking multiple laws. And if you're trying to enlist and you don't have the proper documentation, you can't. And not only that, you may be turned over to the Immigration Service.
Eva, I'm glad you raised that, because the same thought crossed my mind, and I don't know if we've got the expertise here to nail this down. But John Harwood, how about it? Do we have an army of illegal immigrants now, or significant numbers? Eve says, as far as she knows, you can't enlist unless you're documented.
Well, I think we've all noticed that the volunteer military has difficulty attracting a lot of people in this country, and I believe we do have a significant number of illegal immigrants who are serving. And the point the caller raised is very apt, because, you know, yesterday in the immigration fact sheet that Mitt Romney put out, he said that I want to let illegal immigrants earn permanent residency by serving in the armed forces. As the caller suggested, on its face, that is a contradiction, because I don't believe you can walk into a military recruiting office and say, I'm an illegal immigrant, I want to serve.
Right. Does that mean a blind eye has been turned? And in fact, that's what's going on. Like, you know, like, I don't
perhaps
know, like a tomato farm in Florida?
Perhaps like it's done at the farms in Florida or the hotels in Arizona.
Wow. Who knew? Who knew? I want to turn to Fast and Furious. Lots of attention on that this week in the Attorney General. Republicans going very hard on this case where guns were sold to straw buyers, supposed to be tracked back into Mexico to get up to the hierarchy of the drug cartels. Some of those ended up, a bunch of those ended up in bad hands and untracked, and even a Border Patrol agent officer dead. On Wednesday at the meeting of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, South Carolina Republican Congressman, committee member Trey Gowdy said the committee had no choice but to cite Attorney General Eric Holder for contempt of Congress.
This is a sad day, but it is a necessary day. The notion that you can withhold information and documents from Congress, no matter whether you're the party in power or not in power, is wrong.
Sad but necessary, straight party line vote. Every Republican voting to take this to the Congress and get a full vote maybe next week. We'll see if something gets worked out. Holder himself said it had more to do with politics than with trying to get more information on Fast and Furious.
Given the extraordinary nature of the offer that we made and given the extraordinary way in which we have shared materials to date, that I think we are actually involved more in political gamesmanship as opposed to trying to get the information they say they want.
John Harwood, where does this go?
Well, John Boehner, the House Speaker, has said he will take a contempt vote to the full House if documents are not turned over by next week. That is potentially a dicey move, both because Democrats are saying that would mark John Boehner as a partisan speaker, but it also takes Republicans away from the core issue that is working for them and for Mitt Romney in the election, and that is the economy. That's why Republican leaders had somewhat discouraged this effort by Darrell Issa, the chairman of the Oversight Committee. But I think this train has kind of left the station. The administration has taken a sort of aggressive, combative response by claiming executive privilege. So I think this vote is likely to take place, and I think it will be, at minimum, a mixed blessing for Republicans.
We'll come back to the politics of it. Susan Glasser, take it on its face. What do, I mean, and there were versions of this. There was a version of this in the George W. Bush administration. But what were they trying to do here? You know, the Republican claim back in the U.S. is that this was a kind of boomerang play to get assault weapons down there, have bad things happen, and then go for gun control in this country. But just take it on its face. If you track American guns, and of course a lot of them are bought and go to Mexico, if you track them down, what would the foreign policy or law enforcement goal be?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I have to admit that I don't feel like anybody's really sorted out this particular scandal. You're right that there are two different issues here. One is the politics on Capitol Hill, and there is a certain familiarity to this script. We've seen it before. Democratic Congresses, Republican presidents, Republican Congresses, Democratic presidents. And then there is the actual question of what's happening with Mexico. And as you said, American guns have flooded into Mexico in the midst of this drug war. And I think, you know, one thing, by the way, to pay attention to is that Mexico itself is about on the brink of what could end up being a major political leadership change, and their
July 1st presidential election.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think, you know, what's happened is that President Calderon over the last several years has embarked on this very bloody but not necessarily conclusive war on drugs in Mexico in a way that has actually increased tensions between the United States and Mexico. Many Mexicans believe that this is an American problem that they're being forced to deal with on their own turf, that the bloody war is a result of this enormous demand for drugs on the other side of the border. And by the way, with the guns coming into Mexico itself from the United States, as well as the demand for the drugs.
And of course, a lot of guns have come in from all over, including the U.S., with or without Fast and Furious. Nevertheless, Peter, Mansfield, Connecticut. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm with you in that these seem to be the only guns that Congressman Issa and the other Republicans care about. There are tens of thousands of guns going into Mexico. They care only about these 200 or so.
2,000, and shouldn't they care if they were supposed to be tracked and they were lost? I mean, isn't that kind of a big deal or not?
They're making a big deal about 2,000 guns out of thousands and thousands. It just proves to me that it's a political charade.
Jack, thanks, Peter. Jack, how do you read this? I mean, we've got reports out of Washington saying the White House is actually pleased with this because, as John Harwood says, it takes the public's eye a little bit off the huge ball of the economy, which is a tough one for Obama right now, puts it on something else. What do you think, Jack?
That could well be, but if it comes out that they have been covering something up, then it could be extremely damaging to them. I think the Washington Post makes a good distinction today that on executive privilege, the White House is on solid ground saying, no, you can't have wiretap evidence. That has to be protected. But on less solid ground, when they say you can't have internal deliberative documents, those are documents in which, say, a Justice Department person might speculate, well, heck, this crazy Darrell Issa might well hold you in contempt, Mr. Attorney General. Who knows what's there? But it could be embarrassing. You know, on this question of guns, as of 2010, according to studies, 60,000 U.S. guns of all types had been recovered over a four-year
period. And the Attorney
Where?
General...
Where? In Mexico?
In Mexico. Mm-hmm. In Mexico. And the Attorney General of Mexico was asked what the United States could do to help curb gun violence there. And he said to reinstate the assault weapons ban that lapsed in 2004 here. And a study just out in March from NYU connects the lapsing of that ban with an additional 239 deaths annually in cities and towns near the Mexican border. That is probably thousands of deaths they connect with the lapsing of the assault weapon ban here in the United States.
Of course, Jack, the NRA listens to what you just said and says, see, there it is. That was the goal all along, to get back to gun control. Speaking of guns going over borders, Susan Glasser, take us to this border of Syria, which is such a mess, and Turkey, where we read this week that the CIA is sitting on the Turkish side, whatever that means, kind of steering guns now to the groups that it appears to favor inside Syria. What's going on there? What do we know, Susan?
Well, what we know is that Syria is in the midst of an escalating and fairly horrendously violent civil conflict that the Assad regime has decided to dig its heels in. And while there are, according to the New York Times, a small number of CIA agents in Turkey who are working with elements of the opposition to Assad to arm them. At the same time, the real big picture conflict has been over Russia not only exercising its de facto veto power in the UN Security Council to stop the rest of the world from doing anything to stop the violence, but also being the major supplier of arms and weapons to the Syrian regime. Something like 80% of Syria's weapons over the last 5 years have come from Russia, and Moscow has said not only that it is not willing to budge on a political solution to remove Assad from power, but also that it is planning to continue to supply those weapons.
Yeah, here was Putin at the G20 meeting in Los Cabos, Mexico, speaking on Monday in Russian here. And it is hard to parse what he's trying to get at here. John Harwood, listen with us. He says it's important there's not only a change of regime in Syria, but also to reach a situation so that after a change of power, if it happens, it should be done constitutionally so that there's a peace in the country and bloodshed is stopped. I mean, John, how's Washington looking at Moscow's agenda in Syria? We hear all these stories about, you know, Russian ships headed for Syria. This, I mean, now we got the CIA on the border. Are we in an arm wrestling match somehow with Moscow right now over Syria?
Indirectly, we are. And, of course, the president spent much of his time at the G20 in Mexico, concerned about this issue, talking to Vladimir Putin, trying to get him to agree to help ease Assad from power, and Putin wouldn't do it. Putin came out and said, in addition to the clip you just played, that it was up to the people of Syria to decide. But, of course, the popular will of the people of Syria in the middle of a bloody civil conflict is very difficult to discern. And, you know, there's some people who have suggested that perhaps giving Russia a key role in helping to envision the next Syria beyond Assad might be some sort of incentive for them to cooperate to a greater extent with the rest of the world. But there's no sign that that's happening right now. It's a horrible situation.
Susan, in a word, who's got the leverage here now? Washington? Moscow? Toss up?
Well, I think that's one of the big problems is that Putin has an extraordinary amount of power right now in this relationship. Remember, the United States is increasingly dependent on Moscow for being a transit point to ship our military supplies to Afghanistan now that the back door with Pakistan is closed.
Right,
so
boy.
I think Putin is looking pretty strong these days.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Rodney King, dead at 47. As the 1992 riots unfolded in Los Angeles, he appealed for an end to the violence.
Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids?
Rodney King gone. Baseball great Roger Clemens not guilty on all counts in his steroid scandal this week. He choked up on the courthouse steps in Washington.
I put a lot of hard work into that career, and again, I appreciate my teammates that came in and all the emails and phone calls.
And the Miami Heat beat the Oklahoma City Thunder to win MVP LeBron James' first NBA title.
The Miami Heat are once again NBA champions. LeBron James captures that elusive title he so desperately coveted.
We're looking at a week in the news. Holder and contempt, big bank downgrade. Sandusky, the Trayvon case, and courting the Latino vote. John Harwood of CNBC and the New York Times is with us. Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy. Jack Beatty's here. And we will hear later in this hour some stirring oratory from the Burmese democracy champion Aung San Suu Kyi. Susan Glasser, we've got to ask you about Egypt. I mean, here we go back to February of last year, Arab Spring. It all kicks off in such a big way. It just goes up to another level when it comes to Egypt and Cairo and Tahrir Square. But here we were this week, Tuesday night, tens of thousands out, protesting in that same square. And, of course, they're upset about all kinds of things. The military has stepped back in a big way. The so-called transition now pretty unclear, even unclear at this point, who won the runoff presidential election last week. The Muslim Brotherhood candidate claimed it. Mohamed Morsi gave a speech emphasizing the need for all Egyptians to work together and move forward. But he's not the only one, and we don't have results yet.
We are not about taking revenge or settling scores. We are all brothers of this nation. We own it together. And we are equal in rights and duties.
So there he is saying it's mine, but the vote's still out as far as I know, Susan. And you've got the last prime minister under Hosni Mubarak saying, well, maybe it's mine.
Well, that's right. We should see results on Sunday is what we're now being told. But I think your broader point is really the one to focus on, which is to say this couldn't have gone worse in many ways, although some of these outcomes are not surprising. They're nonetheless close to a worst-case scenario. You have a military, the remnants, really, of the Mubarak regime fighting back in a big way. Somebody said last week, and I think this is a fair point, if for the last few months we've had a slow-moving coup in Egypt, now the only difference is that it's not slow-moving anymore. They moved to seize massive power and to eliminate the authorities of the presidency in anticipation of the idea that the Muslim Brotherhood candidate would actually win the election. So basically, you have both a political stalemate, and you have potentially a conflict both publicly and behind the scenes between the ascendant Muslim Brotherhood in the political process and generals who are making it very clear that they are unwilling to give up power.
So there you are, way up in the Foreign Policy Observation Post at Foreign Policy Magazine, editor-in-chief. What does this mean? Is the party over on the Arab Spring? Is somehow the chemistry turned fundamentally in a different way again, this whole big turn of the wheel of political evolution in that great region? Is it not happening?
Well, in all honesty, the party's been over for quite some time, in particular in Egypt. These have been gathering force for quite some time, and it's been actually very clear for many months now that as the observer said, a slow-moving coup by the military was in progress. What's unclear is what's the next play in the game. And unfortunately, the next play in the game, according to everyone, by all accounts, is not going to be a resurgence of power for the young, democracy-minded, Western-oriented liberal activists who triggered this in the first place. That horse has left the barn. Pick your metaphor, but it's not happening.
Wow, amazing. John Harwood, we've got listeners still thinking about immigration here. A question for you from one of them says, hey, John, you had said earlier that Republicans had blocked immigration reform, but our listener says, then why didn't Obama pass comprehensive immigration reform when he had both a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House, Mr. Harwood?
Because there wasn't enough support, even with a Democratic Senate and Democratic House, to get that through, especially in the Senate. Remember, it's very difficult to move anything in the United States Senate without bipartisan support. The president basically fired his ammunition, getting the stimulus package, getting the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill, getting health care passed, and he simply did not have the political capital at that point to do this without Republican cooperation. There was, to reiterate the point that I made earlier, mm-hmm. there was a bipartisan proposal that had advanced and then been shot down in the Congress under a Republican president. President Obama simply didn't have the ability to do it. Interestingly, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that if Mitt Romney wins the election, he might have the ability in a Nixon goes to China kind of way to get Republicans to see their self-interest and to to do something that President Obama might not have been able to do.
Or just enough of them, and Democrats might feel like they had to get on that train. Jack, here's one for you maybe on the economic front. Question from Corey says, if the economic crisis in Europe deepens, does that in some way provide political cover for Obama heading into the election? In other words, can he blame our country's economic woes on the continued problems in Europe, shift attention away from his own policies, Corey writes, which might be difficult to explain or defend? What do you think, Jack? How's that play? Because it's clearly a big possibility.
I think that just lends itself to the Romney critique, which is, Mr. President, you've been in office nearly 4 years now, and you just can't blame other people. You blamed, you know, it's been the Japanese tsunami, it's been gas prices, it's been, now it's Europe. Take responsibility. I just think that's very difficult, even if it's true. And I believe it would be true. That's very difficult for any president to do.
Mitt Romney was at a manufacturing plant in Janesville, Wisconsin this week and went after the president there on the economy.
Look, people are having a hard time. Those unemployment numbers understate the difficulty happening in this country. I wish the president would get out, talk to people. He'd understand just how out of touch he was when he said the private sector is doing fine. It is not. It needs help, and I'm going to get it for it.
I'm going to bring the help, says Mitt Romney. John, I mean, you've got this poll, kind of an outlier this week, though, that showed Obama ahead by, 13 points or something, but that economy just keeps grinding and not in the right direction there. How do you see this shaping up?
Well, first of all, I think I'd be willing to bet Mitt Romney $10,000 that he's not 13 points behind in the race.
Yeah.
You may recall his bet during the debate with Rick Perry.
I
do think that it is the luxury of a challenger to blame everything that happens that's going wrong in the country on the incumbent. And there's not – it's very difficult for President Obama to make the argument, but – oh, yes, but it would have been worse if not for the steps that I had taken. And yes, it was really because of the financial crisis. And we know that recoveries after financial crises are much slower than recoveries from ordinary recessions. That's simply the lot that President Obama has drawn. He thought he was going to get a faster pace of economic growth this spring. But for the third consecutive year, we've had a spring fallback and disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what President Obama is going to have to fight through. He's probably a couple of points ahead in this presidential race, one or two. He's, in my book, a very slight favorite to win re-election, but this is going to be a dogfight to the end.
And other issues will be coming up along the way. I mean, we had yesterday George Zimmerman, this is in the Trayvon Martin case, his defense team released tapes, several different kinds, video and audio of a police interview with George Zimmerman. This is from the early stages of the investigation, and the whole country hearing how Zimmerman conveyed to them his own reenactment of the events that he says led up to the shooting of young Trayvon Martin.
That's when my jacket had moved up and I had my firearm on my right side hip. My jacket moved up and he saw it. I feel like he saw it. He looked at it and he said, "You're going to die tonight." And he reached for it, but he reached, like, I felt his arm going down to my side. And I grabbed it, and I just grabbed my firearm, and I shot him one time.
Jack Beatty, such an explosive case. We saw all the uproar over it a couple of months ago. And now this comes back, and of course, you know, dead men or boys don't speak. But it's just, so it's just Zimmerman's tape, voice, on, and his view on the recording here. But this was shortly after the killing itself, and this is going to get played again and again. How do you see this thing playing out, Jack?
And the context of it, I mean, this is released by the defense, and this has been a bad patch for them because, of course, it's come out that both Mr. Zimmerman and his wife hid from the bail judge several hundred thousand dollars in contributions they were getting, and there were wiretaps that revealed their crude efforts to hide that money. They spoke in code, and I think his wife has even been charged with obstruction, whatever the count is. So it's a bad bad time for the defense, and so we get this this release. Now, how this is going to affect things, I don't know, but clearly it was a bid to affect public opinion about it.
George Zimmerman's take on conveyance of what happened that night, and one more voice from the past. We heard a little bit from Rodney King there, but there was a remarkable NPR interview that Karen Grigsby Bates did earlier this year with Rodney King, years and years after his famous statement. He said he liked it when he heard his famous phrase, "Can't we all get along," repeated, even when it was meant as mockery.
I feel good when I hear people repeat it because they know that we should be all getting along, and that's why they say it. They just tease them because they know when they hear them words, either they're doing something where in their heart they're not supposed to be doing, and they know that they should be working on trying to get along.
Rodney King there, found dead at the bottom of his swimming pool in California this week. I mean, that plaintive, can't we all just get along, John Harwood? I think this country will never get away from that. Rodney King is gone, but that phrase just hangs there as an open question.
Absolutely, it does. And obviously, his case stands as the stands for the enduring power of racial division and difficulty in the country. But I think his point was correct. I think people who make fun of that phrase do understand and are teasing because they understand they should.
At bottom, we've got to figure it out sooner or later, one way or another. John Harwood with CNBC and the New York Times. It's always great to have you, John. Thank you very much for being with us this week.
My pleasure.
And Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief at Foreign Policy Magazine. See her big cover piece, Head of State, about Hillary Clinton and diplomacy in the Twitter era. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jack Beatty, always good to have you here, sir.
Thank you.
In a moment, Aung San Suu Kyi's stirring address to the British Parliament. This is On Point. Burmese democracy champion Aung San Suu Kyi spent 15 years under house arrest in her home country before being elected to Burma's parliament in a remarkable political turn this spring. She's been traveling outside Burma, Myanmar, for the first time in years. Yesterday, the 67-year-old Nobel Prize laureate, Peace Prize laureate, and opposition leader became the first non-head of state to address both houses of British Parliament. She got a standing ovation on arrival to Westminster Hall and was introduced as the conscience of a country and a heroine for humanity. Here's sound from her speech.
It was through learning while at Oxford about two great British leaders, Gladstone and Disraeli, that I first developed my understanding of parliamentary democracy. I learned the basics, that one accepts the decision of the voters, that the governing power is gained and relinquished in accordance with the desires of the electorate. That is the system which goes on, and that ultimately everyone gets another chance. During the years of my house arrest, it was not just the BBC and other broadcasting stations that kept me in touch with the world outside. It was the music of Mozart and Ravi Shankar and the biographies of men and women of different races and religions that convinced me I would never be alone in my struggle. The prizes and honors I received were not so much a personal tribute as a recognition of the basic humanity that unites one isolated person to the rest of the world. During our dark days in the 1990s, a friend sent me a poem by Arthur Hugh Clough. It begins, I think many of you will know it, "Say not the struggle naught availeth." I understand that Winston Churchill, one of the greatest parliamentarians the world has known, used this poem himself as a plea for the United States of America to step in against Nazi Germany. Today, I want to make a rather different point that we can work together, combining political wisdom from East and West to bring the light of democratic values to all peoples in Burma and beyond. I will just read the final verse. I was advised that the whole poem was far too long. And not by eastern windows only, when daylight comes in the light. In front, the sun climbs slow, how slowly, but westward, look, the land is bright. I would like to emphasize in conclusion that this is the most important time for Burma, that this is the moment of our greatest need, and so I would ask that our friends, both here in Britain and beyond, participate and support in and support Burma's efforts towards the establishment of a truly democratic and just society. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to address the members of one of the oldest democratic institutions in the world. Thank you for letting me into your midst. My country has not yet entered the ranks of truly democratic societies, but I am confident that we will get there before too long, with your help. Thank you.
Burmese democracy champion Aung San Suu Kyi speaking to both houses of the British Parliament in Westminster Hall in London yesterday. For a full transcript and video of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Perspective there that we can use as well. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Be the first to find out tomorrow's topics or next week's and guests by going to our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Hit the like button there, and you'll get alerts on upcoming shows right in your news feed. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gale Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Imada, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Emily Johnson and Arjun Singh. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.